Good evening and welcome to the New York Society Library. I'm Mark Bartlett. So glad we have a wonderful crowd out tonight. It's good to see all the chairs full. It's a pleasure to welcome you, and I wanted to thank all of you who have contributed so far to this year's annual appeal. I will be very direct and tell you that the annual appeal that we do this time of the year is really important for the library so we can continue to provide services, build the collection, and have wonderful events like we're going to have tonight. It's my pleasure to now introduce Jules Cohen, who is in the room. Jules is a longtime volunteer and participator in the acquisitions department. He works on a number of committees for us, and he's going to do the honors of introducing our two speakers this evening.
Thanks, Mark. We should also thank Sarah Holliday and Carolyn Waters and other people who've helped make this happen. I'm really not supposed to do this. Suki Shorer, who was a principal dancer at the New York City Ballet, expected to be here. Turned out she couldn't be here, so she emailed me her remarks and asked me to read them, and I'll do that. Not that I'm unable to come up with the remarks of my own. I've admired Meryl Ashley from afar as an audience member when she was dancing for Balanchine, which happens to be the title of her terrific book. It's a book about ballet technique, but it's also a book chock full of recollections of working with Mr. Balanchine. I've had the pleasure of getting to know her personally in the years since she joined Nancy Goldner on the educational project of the Balanchine Foundation. I also know Nancy Goldner. She's my wife. There's a special planet out there, the Balanchine planet. Living and working on it are generations of Balanchinians, a species whose digestion, metabolism, physiology, and mental equilibrium thrives on engagement with Mr. Balanchine's work. They interact with the rest of us in the off season. The fun of sitting next to Nancy at the Ballet is in witnessing that special engagement, the way she looks at the choreography and the dancing. And then there's the pleasure of reading what she has written. And now I'll read Suki's introduction. This is from Suki. I'm pleased to be here tonight to introduce Nancy Goldner and Meryl Ashley. I have known both of them for many years. And there's another reason. I have read and savored Balanchine Variations, Nancy's new book. It's so valuable. It grew out of talks Nancy and Meryl gave around the country where Balanchine ballets were being performed. Her partner on many of these occasions was Meryl Ashley. I bought the book earlier this year. At the time, I was rehearsing SAB students in Concerto Barocco for the annual workshop, and so I read that section to see what Nancy had to say. I was so impressed that I made copies of those pages and gave them to my students. I've seen the ballets Nancy writes about forever, it seems. Some in the San Francisco Ballet, where I began my career at 16, some more recent ones ever since their first performance at New York City Ballet. I danced in a dozen of them for Mr. B, and I have staged part or all of them under his supervision. Still, I learned something new from Nancy's book. Or she cast a different light on details I know well. But her book is not just for insiders and regulars. She writes with a light touch in a very accessible style, welcoming those new to Balanchine, or maybe those new to ballet. Meryl came into New York City Ballet after I did, so I saw her whole career. I have always admired her work ethic, and I was astonished by the virtuosity she achieved. Mr. B was too, and Nancy writes about the living monument that resulted, Ballo della Regina. I did not teach Meryl at SAB, but she took my class from time to time when she was in the company, and we collaborated on the Balanchine Essays, a series of teaching videos. I have always valued her skills. I'm sure you're in for a most informative and interesting evening. Ladies and gentlemen, Nancy and Meryl.
Good evening. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Good. Okay. I want to thank Mark Bartlett and Jules Cohn, who happens to be my husband, and also Suki Shore in absentia. Also, Meryl, I want to thank you.
Likewise.
for joining me in what is a rather unusual format for us. As Suki mentioned, Merrill and I used to visit companies who were performing specific ballets, and we would talk to the audiences of these companies. But we would always talk about a specific ballet, and our talks were very, very focused. Tonight it's a little bit more wide in scope, more free-ranging. I'm sure we'll end up being focused, or I know Merrill will, because that's the way our minds think. But it is a different kind of format, so I want to thank you, Merrill, for being game. Before I forget, somewhere in midway or long of our talk, we'll be seeing a video of the Sanguinic variation from the Four Temperaments. And then at the end, we'll be seeing a fairly good section of Ballo della Regina. And both films feature Merrill Ashley. So I think that's kind of a nice coming together. Well, I guess that I'm on Balanchine's planet, what Jules mentioned. I won't speak for Merrill, but...
I think I am, too.
Okay.
Different side of the planet, but...
Different side, right. But I do love Balanchine's ballets. And this is what I wanted to convey most to my readers in the book that I wrote. One thing that it meant was getting very, very technical in certain ballets at certain moments, getting into certain aspects of technique. And one reason that I did this is because it's one of the reasons that I love Balanchine's ballets. I love the way he can transform really very basic elements of technique into something that is theatrically marvelous. Now, it just so happens that Ballo is a very good example of how he took something rather basic and made it into something rather extravagant and wonderful. And that has to do with the question of épaulement, or just the use of the shoulders. And correct me if I get this wrong, Merrill, but I think... So far,
you're on the right track.
Okay. And what it means is that the audience is always looking at the dancers, always at different angles. Always, the dancer is always changing her or his position toward the audience, and it's mostly in the shoulders, and it's very simple. There's an effacé position, which is open, and then there's a croisé, which is crossed. The open position is open. The crossed position is much more complex, and it has sort of perhaps sometimes darker shadings. So you have light and dark going back and forth.
And Ballo has lots of effacé, which is very light.
Right. What fascinates me is that these positions, you learn the first year that you attend ballet school. There are, I think, 8 or 9 of them as you go around the circle. And you learn them, and you accompany them with a little tendu and little simple port de bras. But very, very, from day one, you should pardon the expression, from day one, students learn all the subtleties of how they can approach the front, how they can approach the audience. And in Ballo, he shows this off in extraordinary ways, and you'll see when we see the film clip, you'll see that the dancers, and especially Merrill, but all the ensemble, are always very quickly changing their angles to the audience. And sometimes they turn all the way around, sometimes their back is toward the audience. But again, it's always at an angle. It's always sculptured in some way. It's never just, sometimes it is, but usually it's not just flat front. That's boring. Balanchine uses that once in a while, and you're always amazed because you haven't seen it before. It's rather startling. So there's just all of the subtlety of play in the shoulders. And you'll see that with Ballo, this playfulness of the shoulders gives infinite variety, surprise. It gives a lot of texture to the ballet. And I'm always, you know, it is really basic, and it always amazes me that other choreographers don't use this element to enliven their ballets. But they tend not to. It's Balanchine who's always taking from the classroom and putting it into the theater, but always, always from the classroom. And I love that connection. And in my book, whenever I saw a chance to write about that connection, I did. The other thing that I wanted to write about or to show is that one can have a real intimacy with these ballets. I guess that's what I mean by love. But one can, the more you see them, you start to feel very, very, very close to them. You can wonder about puzzles and enigmas in them. I just wrote an essay on Mozartiana. I don't know if any of you are familiar with that. But I really struggled with it because it is a very enigmatic ballet, and in the end, I still wasn't able to really sort it out. Even in the most simple question, is this a happy ballet or a sad ballet? Or how much in between? Where does it veer? It's still up in the air for me. There are certain events that happen in the ballet that I don't quite understand yet. They're very interesting. I don't quite know how they fit in. So the ballet is still very much of a puzzle to me. There's also in Mozartiana, someone who develops a kind of a character at one point. He seems to be reluctant to leave the stage. There's a sense of his being an interloper or a loner. And then he drops that character and goes back to being just a very vivacious dancer. But as a writer, and I mean at first as an audience member, but as a writer, it is great fun to write about these puzzles and enigmas, in the process of writing to see really where you go with it. You can also, as an intimate of Balanchine's ballets, you can question certain choices. I think one of the most famous examples that people question, they don't question it, they condemn it. and this is Apollo, Balanchine's first extant ballet and earliest extant ballet and beloved. And one day he just sat down and decided that he was just going to chop off the beginning of the ballet. And so you miss his birth scene. You miss his first solo where he's a baby in swaddling clothes and he takes his first tottering steps. So half the story he decides to leave out. And then at the end he also changed the ending, the apotheosis, and to my mind made it much, much less poetic. So you can ponder this and wonder about it. Balanchine's answer to all of the questions when he did this. And look what he did to Stravinsky's score. You know, he's supposed to like Stravinsky, but, you know, half of it went. Balanchine answered rather petulantly, I think. He said, well, it's my ballet, and I can do what I like with it, which he did. He did what he liked with it. But it is, it's that kind of thing that makes Balanchine a very, very interesting subject. Because most always he does very sensible things, wise things. He'll change ballets. In the end, it kind of comes together. But this action on Apollo is something that, it's just something to think about. It makes the repertory, it makes Balanchine really a very, very living person. Another, I don't know if any of you saw the old version of Square Dance. But in the original version, there was a square dance caller on stage, and the orchestra sat along with the dancers on the side of the stage. And that was one kind of ballet. Then years later, he decided that he would remove the square dance caller and that he would move the orchestra into the pit, which gave the dancers then the full stage. And especially moving the orchestra into the pit gave the ballet a very, very different look. It was still called square dance, but it was a much more elegant, pristine piece of work.
He wanted to change the name.
He did.
He couldn't decide what to call it. He asked me once what I thought it should
really?
Be called, and I couldn't come up with anything either.
Huh. Could have called it Vivaldi Corelli or something. that's the usual. Well, that's interesting to know. I didn't know that. I'm sorry you didn't come up with another name.
I know.
But, okay, it's square dance. But, you know, again, you can wonder about the decisions that went into that. You can think, interestingly, about the way the ballet changed, which way you like better, which way you like less. So, again, there's always lots of sort of thinking to do about this repertory. And one can also have, as I do, favorite moments. And to me, this is the most sort of intimate relationship that I have with Balanchine. Because it's not just, you know, it's just not this work of art up there, you know, on the other side of the footlights. And there it is, and there I am, or the audience. And never the twain shall meet. It's, as you watch more, you begin to find the little nooks and crannies, the little seconds, maybe the little moments that somehow become to mean a great, great deal to you. Some of these moments really draw you in a sense they become larger than the choreography itself. And sometimes they're even kind of lifelike situations. So I thought I would just mention a few of these to give you an idea of the way I think and what I hope the book conveyed. But in Apollo, one of my favorite moments in Apollo is when the three muses are lined up, and I think each woman has her hands on the shoulder of the woman in front, so
underneath.
That they're underneath. Okay. So that they are joined in some way, and they're standing on point, and their heads are thrown way back so that they can't see where they're going, and Apollo is in back of them, and he gives them just a little push. Well, the push depends on the performance, but it's a little push, and off they go, bourring into this large circle with their heads thrown back. And sometimes it brings tears to my eyes because I think, you know, this is the parents sending the children out into the world to make their own way. Sometimes I think of David Copperfield, David, you know, trudging along. Balanchine is neat. I mean, he really makes your mind move in associations and thoughts. But I'm always very struck by the poignancy of that moment and the fact that their heads are thrown back. You see, they can't see where they're going, and that suggests that they're going out into this big, wide, unknown world that they don't know very well. So I love that moment. Sometimes after a very beautiful adagio, like in Concerto Barocco, at the end of the Andante of Divertimento, several other ballets, at the end of a very long adagio, the man will kiss the woman's hand, or they will simply, in Concerto Barocco, they simply bow formally and walk off in opposite directions. And it's just this very simple little gesture. And it's, to me, always a very, very special moment because, first of all, it's an acknowledgement from Balanchine and from the dancers, too, of this very, very beautiful passage of dancing and time that we've been through. And also, the bow signals very much the end. And I think one of the sad things about music and dance is that it ends. I mean, it's a temporal form, and when it's over, and it's the end. And I think also the fact that because the gesture, the bow, or the kiss of the hand is so formal, it kind of, it sort of undercuts in some way, or the beauty of the moment, the seriousness of the moment. You know, it's this large event that's happening. It's the end, but it's all marked by this little formal gesture. And I guess it sometimes gives me a chill because of that. So I think I've given you enough of my favorite moments, Mira.
I certainly have many, many favorite moments too. It's hard really to kind of pare them down to a few to talk about. But I think you've been talking about Apollo a lot. And I, as a young girl in the company, I think, or when I first watched New York City Ballet, even as a student at the School of American Ballet, Apollo became instantaneously one of my favorite ballets to watch. And one of the sections that I was just captivated by came at the end of the ballet, where the three muses and Apollo are this pulsating music, bum 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 bum, ba da da ba da, and they continue kind of pulsating and moving, and then it turns into the chariot. The three muses become the horses, and Apollo's behind. Guiding the chariot, and that whole section, I used to be up in the dressing room when I was in the Court of Ballet with my friends, and we were dancing in the dressing room doing those steps. We were just, and even to this day, if I hear that music, I cannot sit still. I pity the people next to me in the audience if I'm sitting next to them, because I can't sit still. I want to move to that music. It's just fantastic. And I think there's something about Stravinsky's music, that underlying pulse is always there. It's what Balanchine was attracted to somehow, I think, and what made him use that music so much. And in Stravinsky Violin Concerto, there's another fantastic finale, which I never did the ballet, but to this day, someday I will learn that finale. But I look at that finale, and I go, I want to know those steps. I want to respond to that music in that way. It is so perfect, and it's so filled with passion, commitment, life, just it's spirit. And everybody's doing it together. It's one of those big finales where everybody's doing the same thing at the same time. And it just sweeps me off my feet. So that was a ballet I didn't even do. But I love watching it. I love thinking about doing it. Another ballet that I would just be standing in the wings, and already I was just, I'd hear the music for Allegro Brilliant start with this rumble, and I just get chills. I can't wait for the music to, music just kind of keeps building and building and building, and suddenly you saute out of the wing and run as fast as you can and stop and change direction and go the other way and pose and pose. And it just, it's so filled with life. It so matches the music. It's this gives you this fantastic sense of freedom and yet of making movements that convey the music so perfectly and yet add your own love of movement and beauty and femininity and strength. And it's so many things blended together. So ting out in arabesque is the simplest movement. But I think that, as you said, I mean, Balanchine could take some of the simplest things, and because of the way he matched them with the music, they became something much more special than just a sauté in arabesque or walks on point or a turn. It was the way he combined the steps, chose the order of the steps and put them together and based on the music. It was just amazing what he did. He would take very ordinary things and make them virtuosic or special. That classroom steps, tombé pas de bray, walks on point, what could be simpler? And just like this. And he turns it into something thrilling. I think there are moments, too, from a dancer's point of view, you're in a performance, and you know, some steps are easier to do than others for you. A lot of the steps that he created in Bala for me are, I don't want to say they're easy, but they suited me. They fit me and what I did best and what I liked to do best, which was move quickly, cleanly, with joy. That was me. Mm-hmm. And when you put other ballet dancers in those steps, they don't feel comfortable, and they don't feel a sense of joy. They're struggling. So inevitably, I mean, we all do ballets that were created on other people, and so you find steps that you like but can't do. You find steps that you like and they're great. You really enjoy doing them. You find steps that change from time to time based on partly your mood of the day. Maybe it was a long, hard day. Maybe I remember one night a relative had passed away, and I was doing Symphony in C, second movement, and it came to this port de bras, looking up at the sky, and I had a whole new perception that night, because I felt like I was looking up at heaven and thinking of this person. And I had never had that thought before. And yet, every time I did the ballet after that, even though maybe it wasn't foremost in my mind, I thought about it. It started coloring what I did. Changes in tempo, too, force you to do a step a different way. And sometimes you discover new things about a step or a ballet that you never would have understood before or never would have thought to try because it's either too fast or too slow. And sometimes those little moments, those spontaneous moments, become a favorite moment. And there was one of those in Balo on the step that was, I thought, kind of a little throwaway step. It was just a transitional step. Walk, 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 toy, and dégagé, and then I'm going to go run and do something else. And when I had late in my career, I was off stage for almost 2 years with hip problems, and I did manage to get back, and I was doing Balo. I think it was the first time I was doing Balo after this long hiatus, and it meant so much to me to be out there doing those steps again. And I came to this one point, walk, 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 kicked my leg, and the joy, the absolute amazement that I was out there doing this again just overtook me. And someone actually took a picture of that moment, and I can just see the pleasure, the special joy I felt of that moment. And it was a nothing little moment. And now when I teach the ballet, I try and get that from people and turn it into something special rather than just walk the dégagé. It's not an exciting step, but it can be an exciting moment. I think then there are other steps that make you feel like you're doing something that's not humanly, I don't even know how to put this, not humanly possible. I mean, to move through air feeling like there's no gravity is something it's very hard to get on Earth anyway. Maybe if you go to the moon, you can get it. But in Four Temperaments, there are these, it happens twice, there's this circle of lifts that are very low, and the boy picks you up. I'm over here, I'm where Nancy is, and he picks me up from the side, and he, as he's running in a circle, he puts me over here and puts me down and then lifts me up. And it's like, I feel like I'm a gazelle or something. One of those, you know, you jump and they hang in the air and they lightly touch the floor and then they're going in the air again. And you're pushing the air, you feel weightless. I'm sure the boy doesn't feel that. But the girl is made to feel like there is no gravity. And you're covering space at a much faster rate than you could yourself. And you're just hovering over the stage like you're levitating. And there's nothing stopping you. It is the most amazing feeling. And I think that in contrast to the rest of the steps in the sanguinic section, well, really, in a way, the rest of the ballet, but it has very clear, the rest of the ballet has a lot of syncopated steps, the rhythms are very clear. There's one section I just love, point heel, change, and your hips are slung out, and your body's changing directions, and it's like you're doing a tap dance. And then suddenly it goes from this tap dance into this smooth, otherworldly presentation. It is phenomenal. And again, it's just lifts. It's just grand jeté lift, but it's become something really unique. So we have.
Let me just one more just thing. This is a wonderful example of how the dancer feels in contrast to how an audience member like myself feels about those lifts. I mean, they are very smooth, But for me, I always, part of the power of those lifts is that I always feel that even though she's kind of gliding through space, that she's really pushing, that she's sort of pushing the air.
Well, and the arms are, you're pushing the
right,
air.
Right, right, but it has a weight to it. I mean,
it
you're
has
feeling
a weight,
like you're climbing.
But a weightlessness at the same time. It's really,
yeah.
Maybe that's why it's so special.
Maybe.
You feel the resistance.
Yes,
and
yes.
And yet you're never on the ground.
Right.
And you feel
right. But to me, if it's sitting in the audience, I always feel it's like it has sort of weight. And another thing, an odd thing about the weight is that in sanguinic, sometimes you kick your legs real high, but a lot of the times you hold them kind of low.
Mm-hmm.
And that low also has an odd kind of weight to me, to my way of thinking. It's sort of like, you know, less is more, but also low is more.
Well,
low, is more.
Yeah.
Low is more. Low is more. It's
powerful. Well, why don't we let them decide?
Okay.
Well, let's watch sanguinic.
Thank you.
Okay, we can stop it now and we'll pick it up, okay?
Yeah, we'll see something else later. Yeah,
that was good.
Thank you.
Also, it's a good ballet. Video. We just saw some video. Daniel Duell. That was the next.
Yeah, Adam was coming next.
He's coming next. So, video. In writing my book, I used tapes of current performances because that was the only thing that was available to me. And of course, there are really very little. There's very little film record of earlier performances. And there was a very, very interesting business using videotape, because very often what I saw on the tape was not as I remembered it. And actually, I had sort of an same experience with this sanguinic, with your thing around. I mean, you know, it's not quite, it was different at some other time. There was a little bit more, I think, push.
I think there was too, but you have to remember that this was filmed, you know, all day long.
Mm-hmm.
How many times did we do those?
Yes. Yeah. No, it was fine.
Many times. Well, no, I mean, I see things there that I would like, you know,
to do.
That I think should be emphasized a little more in one way or another.
Yeah.
But the filming is, for television, is a whole different thing, because you have to do so many rehearsals for the camera, and then you're waiting around, and they're never ready, and then finally go, we're ready, and it's 3 hours later, and you're stone cold, and you've been on your feet all day long, and you're not, and there's no audience, and it's to tape music, and it's just not, it's very hard to bring that same kind of commitment and energy repeatedly, time after time after time. So.
Yeah. I think you did. I mean, I think this is a very good performance of Four Temperaments. But anyway, using video, I often had experiences like with watching this where it wasn't quite the same as I remembered it. But, you know, but okay. But I was always dealing with the present and my memory. And sort of I was in two time zones at the same time, which was sort of interesting, sometimes a little unsettling, but okay. But the problem is that very often what I was, the current videos that I was seeing didn't match in my mind the richness of some of the moments of the ballets. And so I was always wrestling with the thing of, well, am I being nostalgic? Is it because, you know, the first time is the most important time that you see anything. Is my imagination getting away with me? Am I making things up about how different it was then, as it is compared to what I see now? And I had to really trust my first impressions, and really believe that the things that I remembered really did exist. They really were there. And then I had to bring those memories back into the present so that I could look at the choreography it is today, so that I could sort of enrich it with the memories that I had. So I was always going back and forth, back and forth. Now obviously I'm not talking about choreography or steps per se, because frankly I cannot remember changes. But I am talking about the meaning or the effectiveness of the choreography, about dancers shaping the steps, that sort of thing. And they shape the steps either by, well, one good way of doing it is to listen to the music, is to really listen to the music as you're dancing. Another way is to sort of dream up storylines for yourself, like Meryl raising her arms in Concerto Barocco and seeing heaven. I mean, but the dancers have to be very alive to the moment, and their minds have to be active too, and they have to have ideas about what they're doing. They have to find some sort of continuity. They have to show the difference between big and little, which sounds simplistic in a way, but it's very important. It's difficult to do. There are all kinds of things, mental things, that dancers need to be doing while they're performing. And for me, anyway, that's what really fills out a Balanchine ballet. Now, supposedly Balanchine used to say to his dancers, you know, just Just do the steps, dear. Just do the steps, dear. Well, yes, one does want to see the steps, but one wants to see a lot more. And one of the, you know, I've been a critic for so many years, you'd think that I would know that dancers are very, very important to one's experience of a dance, but I really learned it while I was writing this book, that these ballets owe a great deal to the dancers who did them. So I think now I'd like to ask you, Meryl, how you shape dances. And
well, I think, as you said, I mean, the music, for me, is the first place I start, really. Mm-hmm. Listening to the music, trying to understand what, I mean, first of all, it's kind of a simplistic, you know, is it romantic? Is it exciting? Is it atonal? Is it, what is, you know, what kind of mood is it? And then, because Balanchine was such a musician, he clearly had studied the music, he knew the music inside out, and he had his own reactions to it. He had gotten some idea in his mind about what the ballet would be like. Both times he did a ballet for me, one was Balo and the other was Ballade. Both times he came up to me and kind of said, with Balo, he said, well, dear, this will be virtuoso ballet. And then the next time with Ballade, he said, oh, it would be beautiful. And I thought, yeah, all your ballets are beautiful. What does that mean? You know, but then after the ballet was done, I thought, yes, it was a beautiful ballet. It was had a romantic feeling, but it was a very unusual ballet. Anyway, and then Balanchine would also look at the dancers in front of them and be motivated by them. What did they do well? Were you going to challenge them in a way that they were happiest, or were you going to challenge them in a way that would make them grow? And he did both. And he would blend them. You know, certainly with me and Ballade, Bala was everything I liked, everything. moving fast. And then in Ballade, this was a ballet that had a very lyrical, romantic feeling to it. And I think at that point in my career, being lyrical was hard for me. But I think in an effort to keep me comfortable, he made it fast. Now, being fast and lyrical don't go together too well. And it was really a challenge, really, really a challenge for me. And I know I heard Suzanne Farrell talk about how when he choreographed Don Quixote for her, he knew that she didn't bore well, and he put bores throughout the entire ballet to force her to work on them. And then she had beautiful bores. I think he did the same thing with many people. He knew what we did well, he knew what we didn't do well. And depending on his mood, depending on what was required that season, you know, who was healthy, who was not healthy, all sorts of reasons. He decided what he would do. Then, based on his idea in the ballet, he used a certain vocabulary. And as a dancer, you look at the steps and you see what type of vocabulary he's using. It's like in writing. Mm-hmm. You can't suddenly put lots of informal things, slang in a very formal piece. And yet Balanchine did take in a classical ballet like Divertimento number 15, he made it jazzy to Mozart, you know. But he did that consistently throughout, so it wasn't jarring, and he wanted that flavor. But as a dancer, you try and look at the vocabulary and see what the style is, what the mood is, and feel your own personal reactions to the music and the steps. And some steps you're going to highlight more because you like them better, or you can do them more easily. And others, maybe it's not your best thing, and you try and kind of cover up that you're not so good at that. I think, going back to the music, Balanchine was tied so completely to the music. The Nutcracker Pas de Deux music is a G major scale in reverse. Da 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 da, except da 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 da. It's just G major scale. That's all it is, with an unusual rhythm. And I think Balanchine, as he decided what steps he was going to do, did something very similar. He took a very spare
vocabulary. Very simple, very basic, elegant, and put it together in that kind of unusual way, you know, and then in a way that built, and just like the music did, it builds and it builds, and suddenly it's so exciting, and they jump on the shoulder. You know, and yet you have to maintain a graciousness, you have to maintain an elegance, a simplicity. You can't get too many flourishes in there.
But he was working in the Petipa tradition there too, and I think that probably was responsible for some of the simplicity and elegance.
Well, I think so too, but I think it helped that the music was simple too. I think he didn't put lots of complicated things in. It was very Petipa could be complicated too, but this was pretty spare. Mm-hmm. Then I'm going to skip to Gershwin and The Man I Love. A very different type of music, and it's a pas de deux that doesn't literally have a story, but obviously it's going to be romantic. Balanchine took the lyrics and knew it was about the man I love. And when I first saw this pas de deux, I loved it. I thought it was wonderful. And yet I couldn't really analyze why I thought it was wonderful and what was really going on there to make it so effective. Because once again, the steps, the beginning of the pas de deux, the couple, they come on, she's boring, he's walking, she kind of turns, they bore a little more, she's boring backwards, she turns, she bores forward, she falls, she bores some more, she falls, she comes up, she bores. I mean, what is this? It's not that complicated. I couldn't figure out why it was so effective. And I realized later that that Balanchine was very clever in the way he created the dramatic effect, that the woman was always sort of being coy. They were together, but she wasn't committed at all to this man, or not letting him know, anyway. And she'd kind of move away from him, and he'd catch up subtly, and then she'd be a little flirtatious, and she'd turn around and try and avoid him, and he'd kind of snare her with his arm, and then swoon, they'd swoon, and then that's too much, she'd go under his arm and leave again. She was always kind of leaving, he was always catching up, leave, catch up. And then suddenly, at one point in the middle, more toward the middle of the pas de deux, she stops leaving quite so much. She stays close to him a little more, and she starts to sort of express the happiness, kind of transcendent feeling that you get when you're falling in love and the world's wonderful. Oh, she's just spinning in happiness. And yet she still hasn't committed herself. And even right at the end of the pas de deux, she's doing a développé, and he's holding her hands, and she's kind of pulling away from him. And then he takes control of her. And then finally at the end, she surrenders, and he swoops her off her feet, and off they go.
End of story. Right.
But it took me a long time to realize what was happening. And I think it takes time. As you know, young dancers don't see it, even when you try and explain it to them. They don't get it. It's a bunch of steps, and you're dealing with the complexities of the technical problems and the fatigue and the, you know, there are all sorts of things to think about.
So I think, you know what?
We should go on.
Yeah. Maybe I'll start talking about Balo.
Okay.
Okay. Because it is getting on.
Yeah, it's getting late.
Right.
Yeah.
We're eventually going to see parts of Ballo della Regina, and I talked about all of the angles that you'll see the dancers at, moving very quickly, but you'll still see it. And sometimes they're in circles, sometimes you'll see the back. But so I've been over that. But the other, of course, the obvious thing, and this main thing about Ballo della Regina, is the footwork. And I mean, the footwork is always fast in Balanchine's in Balanchine ballet. It's very precise, it's very clean, and there's a lot of it. But I think in Ballo, he took it to a new level, and the whole thing is really quite remarkable. And the other day I was walking on 80th Street, I think, between Madison and the park, And there are three trees there on the north side that seem to attract all the birds in the neighborhood around nightfall. I don't know if any of you
I know those trees.
You do?
I do.
Well, and I heard all of this lovely twittering song, and I thought, gosh, that's sort of like the Fecan Ballo. It's so pretty and kind of nice. So I guess what I'd like you to talk about, Merrill, is that footwork and how it was accomplished. How did Balanchine achieve that?
Well,
technical thing.
It starts in class with the most basic steps you can do, which is the temps de battement. And he emphasized temps de battement. It seems like a very simple step. Open your leg front, close it to fifth, side or back. What's so hard about this? But the way Balanchine asked us to do temps de battement incorporated every subtlety you can think of. There was timing, there was the turnout, there was precision in direction. So it was exactly in the center of your body to the front and the back and exactly in line with your shoulder. It couldn't vary. How much contact you had with the floor, how heavy the contact was with the floor. I could talk about tendus for an hour. It's so complex. And he insisted on all those things and worked on it over and over and over again and getting the timing of it and not slurring the movement. And he would start extremely slowly. 32 front, 32 side, 32 back, and your muscles were screaming. Then faster, 16, 8 faster, 4, and suddenly you were like, and when you did that consistently enough, if you could get through the difficulty of the physical and mental kind of anxiety of it all, you began to be able to move with a kind of clarity and speed that was unknown. And I happened to like to move fast. It appealed to me. And so it became sort of one of my trademarks. But he worked very hard on it, the precision mm-hmm. of everything. Mm-hmm. How do you put a foot down? It can't just go down to the floor. Mm-hmm. How do you present, just like you present a hand, you present a foot on the floor. And it can have very different meanings depending on how you do it.
Mm-hmm.
And how your legs relate in fifth position and how it has to be precise. And mm-hmm. he used all of that technique that he worked on endlessly in class in Ballo.
Yeah.
So I think given the time,
we
should...
Right, just one more thing that I want to say about it, and then you should show it. And just that, I just want to sort of prime you for a wonderful moment in Ballo, and it's at the end, it's during the finale, and you'll see Merrill being held up, being partnered by Robert Weiss, and her arm, her leg is held real high, like that. And then, instead of just bringing it down, which happens most of the time, she brings it down into sort of little notches, like this. You call it a strobe.
Well, it's like a strobe effect.
It's a
like
strobe effect.
Like you were
effect.
Watching the
right,
ballet
right.
of a strobe.
And the thing is that it is like the ultimate icing on this cake. I mean, the whole ballet has been virtuoso, has been detail, has been extravagant in its detail, in its difficulty, in its complexity, and everything like that. And then here, finally, he figures out yet another way to make it very, very detailed and very delightful. And that is, you know, the leg coming down like this. And one, I don't know if you'll quite be able to see it, but Merrill in her book, Dancing for Balanchine, writes that she understood the intent of that, the motion of the leg, and that she figured out, she understood that if she raised her leg just slightly before she brought it down, slightly before she did it.
It's imperceptible, but
yeah.
It's not just da.
No, it's just a little.
There's a little little breath before
mm-hmm.
you close it again.
Right, right. And that's what I think accounts for some of the lightness and the deliciousness of that moment. So I think we should see.
Yeah, there are two sections. The first
mm.
section has my first two solos, and then there'll be a brief break, and then it goes more into the coda
mm-hmm.
for time purposes. So.
Right, because it is.
Okay.
Thank you.
So I think questions. Just because of time, we have time
Do
for
we
a
have
few questions.
For, okay. Anybody?
Yes.
It's not a question, it's a comment on Balanchine, because one of the ballets of his, I danced in very few in my ex-career long ago, but one of them was the Concerto Barocco, and what I found in this ballet, I began by hating it, because I was in the court of ballet, and you hop on point across the stage and change direction quickly, and I used to come off literally with bloody pointers. So I hated it. But when I got a little better at it, I realized that he had, and to use the overworked word genius, he was a true genius with matching this music to the steps, because in this, Bach had four strains of music in it, and every one of those strains was honored by steps, and he did it in such a fantastic way that it's one of my favorite ballets, even though it was very difficult, the court of
ballet. Yeah,
that's true.
And the other one that I adore is Serenade, a very early ballet, and there's such a cute story about that one, because I was told that when he choreographed it, I don't know where, but he wasn't appreciated, and dancers came and dancers went, and they didn't show up. And one of the dancers one day slipped and fell early on in the ballet. And he kept it in the choreography. But as a result, I saw it one day in New York City when I was no longer dancing, and the woman next to me, when the dancer fell, went, and she grabbed my arm by mistake be. And at the end of the intermission, she said, "What did you say?" He kept it in, and he made it beautiful, and everybody thought, oh, some poor dancer in the New York City Ballet slipped and fell on stage. How embarrassing. But that was in the choreography.
Yes, it's a well-known. That's a well-known.
Which is so, was so darling and bizarre.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Or?
It wasn't a question.
Oh, and a comment. Oh, I'm sorry. Comment. Anybody want to say anything? Or?
Isn't it difficult for you to teach ballet, even at ABT, where the dancing was so beautiful, but it wasn't in my passionate zone of Balanchine, even though I did not dance for Balanchine, being there practically every night. You were in my body. I danced with you every step on stage, and wasn't there. Isn't it sometimes just frustrating?
Well, it is, but I also know how much the dancers try. I see where they start and where they end up by the time they get on stage. And for the most part, people make a tremendous amount of progress. And they also make it very clear that they enjoy doing the ballet. You know, I see that. I know that in the end, it's the overall effect is not what I aspire to, but every time they do it, they learn more. And that kind of speed, if you're not trained in class the way we were, those steps are really daunting. And it's almost impossible in the space of 2 or 3 weeks to get your body to do that. It took me how many years before I could do that? You know, I mean, that was at least 10 years of studying with Balanchine, doing that every day, killing yourself. And they're not going to do that. They don't take class that way. Nobody teaches that at ABT. And so it's a form of training, and it gives you the most, in my mind, his training gave you the most refinement possible. You can do anything after you've learned Balanchine, anything. And the vice versa is not true. The Russians can't do Balanchine very well, and people not trained in the Balanchine style really struggle. But for me, it's gratifying to see their pleasure and their interest in learning and to see how they grow doing it. So.
It was an honor to be part of that era, whether you were a dancer or whether you were part of Balanchine's planet in the audience.
I feel that way. Well, it was a privilege to be there in that era.
He was the best teacher I ever had, and yet he never taught me. Can you understand?
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. He taught the audience for sure.
And I always envy people who could hear music and know what the first two notes, what symphony or what it was. And because of Balanchine teaching me, I could do that now.
Yes, absolutely.
All the time,
yes.
And I'm quite proud of it.
I would like to say one thing in honor of Meryl. Vis-a-vis Balanchine. Mm-hmm. I once heard Peter Martin say that there were steps, they called them the Meryl steps, and nobody else but Meryl could do them. And I believe it, seeing that. And I know, I guess the other dancers came after Meryl and tried and did it, but not like Meryl. And it was a Meryl step because it was fast, clean, wonderfully done, etc. So my compliments
to
Meryl.
Thank you very much. Yes.
Is it ever a temptation to stage an earlier version of the ballet that forces to be?
Well, I think that's a big. It's a controversial subject about what version to stage, and I don't have the perfect answer to that question. There are people who stage Balanchine ballets early on. They know an earlier version, and they go around and they stage what they know. And then the problem comes when a company goes to do that ballet again, and someone else goes to look at the ballet, and then they go, "Well, what's that? I'm not familiar with that." And then there's starts a controversy.
Does the trust get involved?
No, not really. Not really. I think. I, at one point, tried to start, encourage the trust to try and, even if there were going to be sort of vintages, you know, to try and codify. This is the version, let's say, from the 50s, this is the version from the 60s and the 70s. So there would be clarity as to what version it is. So if someone goes, you could study that and know what you're about to see, and not confuse people.
You know, I think from my point of view, I mean, I know there are many different versions. Some of the differences are not, I mean, they're important when you want to tell the dancers what to do. But in terms of the effect of the ballet or the meaning of the ballet, they're not that important. And to me, the most important thing that a ballet master or mistress can do is to convey the meaning of the ballet, to give it shape, to inspire the dancers to think about it, to make it look like ballet A and not like ballet B. And sometimes I think that there's too much attention paid on this version and that version, and not enough on the kind of really education that ballet masters need to do when they're teaching these ballets. So.
Well, I have a feeling that we should end on that note, that controversy.
That controversy.